You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Foz Mamoon, and Seth Miller.
So did you know that rockets fly?
We sure as heck saw one tonight, Seth.
We did. Welcome to episode, I believe, 142 of Dots, Lines, and Destinations. This is Seth running the show tonight, so you're all in trouble. And I am joined by Howard Slutskin, who currently lives in Canada.
I do, in Vancouver.
Are you always from Canada?
I have been. I have to admit that, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, born in Montreal, raised in Toronto, living in Vancouver now.
Excellent. Did you ever spend any time in the prairies or the Maritimes?
I had a contract where I spent about a summer in Winnipeg where the mosquitoes have transponders. They're about the size of a Cessna 172.
Nice.
Yeah. So it gets interesting. And a little bit of time down in the Maritimes where the lobsters are really good.
Yes, I agree with
you. Absolutely.
I definitely agree with the Maritimes part. I haven't had my opportunity to experience the...
Well, I think we had a little bit of an exchange about people getting on the planes with lobsters
right.
In the box, didn't we?
Yeah, when Southwest Airlines apparently told someone they couldn't fly with lobsters because it was a TSA regulation.
And we're not talking about a medical condition. We're actually physically, we're talking about lobsters in a box.
Yes.
Underneath the seats. So
dinner to go.
Yeah. Which at Halifax.
I guess it wasn't dinner yet because it was still live. But.
True. Halifax Airport, it's always entertaining to see how many people are getting on with their little boxes of lobsters.
They do it in Boston. They do it a lot of places. Maine, Portland.
It makes one wonder how many times they get loose on purpose.
That would be fun. I actually have a couple friends who are like absurdly scared of lobsters. Even with the rubber bands on the claws and whatever, and if we take the rubber bands off, it's even more fun to like. But like, we would be cooking dinner, like big lobster dinner, and one of them would be like freaking out, hiding somewhere, and you'd sneak out into their room. I was in college, sneak into their room and like bring a lobster with you. Chaos and mayhem ensued.
Well, I think that it could be very interesting on some of the flights these days with high density seating. Anyway,
pinch.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, back to the original topic at hand. We're sitting in a random conference room in Cocoa Beach, Florida, having earlier this evening watched SpaceX put a Falcon 9 launch up coming out of Cape Canaveral, pad 39A, the infamous Apollo 11 pad.
That, maybe famous, not infamous. Maybe.
Well, to a proper dork, it's somewhat infamous.
Yeah, okay.
Famous.
Yeah.
The famous Apollo 11 pad that over at Kennedy Space Center.
And space shuttles.
And space shuttles. First and last space shuttle that launches, I think.
I believe so.
And now it's SpaceX has got its sort of grip on there. And they put Falcon 9 up, and it had the Inmarsat I-5F4. And the I-5 means it's the fifth generation of Inmarsat constellation. F4 means it's the fourth satellite in that three-satellite constellation.
Which is interesting when you think about it.
Always fun that way. It was originally spec'd as a sort of three-satellite global coverage, so you can put, if you've got three, if everybody remembers from watching Independence Day, if you've got three positioned properly around the Earth, you can properly communicate and cover the whole thing.
And the concept of geostationary satellites was popularized by the famous writer Sir Arthur C. Clarke, who wrote 2001, among others. He came up with some rather interesting ideas over the years that have turned into reality, not science fiction.
Science fiction becomes reality.
Yeah, it does sometimes. So yeah, F4 was as you say, it was originally designed to be a ground spare. But Inmarsat decided to spend the money to launch it, and it makes me wonder if they had really a proper deal, such a deal, from SpaceX to launch, because they were originally going to launch on the still-in-development Falcon Heavy,
right?
Which the booster we saw tonight was the Falcon 9, which is a single core with nine engines on it. The Falcon Heavy, they're going to be strapping three of those suckers together with 27 engines. And F4 is a big satellite. It's 14,000 pounds. It's almost 150 feet from one end of the solar panel to the other, and it's a Boeing, what they call a satellite bus. That's the description that's used, the 702. And it's one of the, if not the heaviest payload, one of the heaviest payloads that the Falcon 9 has boosted. So this time, unfortunately for us...
No landing.
So they had to use all the gas, and they didn't even have the landing legs on it or the reentry fins.
Yeah. Because they needed not only did they not have the space for the fuel for it, they didn't waste the legs and the fins. So
exactly.
There was zero chance of that ever happening.
That extra little bit of weight and perhaps that extra little bit of drag
made
a difference, but apparently boosted into a perfect orbit. Geostationary transfer orbit.
Yeah, that's what we've been told. So, waiting to see over the next couple of weeks as they properly get the orbit in place and actually decide where they're going to put it. There's somewhat bizarre circumstances around this launch. They've put a satellite into orbit now, and still haven't announced where they're going to place it as its final position and turn it on to put it into service.
Yeah, it's a little bit odd. They're saying that they'll move it into place where they can add additional capacity, where right. there's higher demand. So,
if you've got three with full global coverage, of course, it's going to be overlapped to something. That makes sense.
Absolutely.
But it's still bizarre to me. I can't tell if they really haven't decided or if they think there's a competitive secret that they're trying to keep.
Perhaps. I mean, we know that Viasat 2 is launching in just a few
weeks. 2 weeks, yeah.
And
it's going to be that one, too.
And it's going to be up there, lucky guy. Jealous.
I try.
Yeah, well, there you go. But it's going to be positioned kind of below the east coast of the U.S.
Sure, covering the Caribbean
over
and
the equator.
North America.
And it's also going to do the bridge over the North Atlantic.
Yeah.
So for most transatlantic flights, it'll be able to provide coverage. And that's I see that we're hitting a tipping point where the Ka band coverage, 2Ku coverage, we're getting to the point where, except for the very high polar latitudes, which may never be covered,
right?
But who knows what else comes along? We're going to have pretty darn good aero connectivity right around the globe, and it's pretty nifty.
Yeah, and if you know an airline wants to come up with sort of a hybrid solution, there are options with Iridium Next, which is also launching on a series of 8 SpaceX launches. They did their first back in January or February, I think, and they've got 7 more to go. Their next one is soon. I actually can't remember. I think it's in June.
Yeah,
if not, it's in July. It's, but they're also on SpaceX, but they're doing theirs at Vandenberg,
right,
out in California.
For a polar orbit.
Those do full sort of a mesh, sort of like the LEO-MEO constellations that we've heard, the low Earth orbit and middle Earth orbit. So we get in trouble for not explaining some of the concepts, and this is especially complicated. So geostationary is the furthest from Earth. They orbit about 22,000 miles
that's
up.
That's right.
And the satellite appears to be stationary because it orbits at the same speed as the Earth rotates.
And there's only one band over the equator.
And they all sit over the equator.
22,000 miles.
So you basically sort of have the cone that can reach from the equator out to plus or minus 80 to 85 degrees, depending on signal strength and a few other things.
Yep.
But once a satellite's in position, it covers a certain area. And they can move, and there's some flexibility in many of the newer ones. But generally speaking, once it's there, you've got your coverage zone, versus low Earth orbit or middle Earth orbit or the Iridium Next constellation is a good example where the satellites actually are constantly moving. It's sort of like the GPS satellite constellation where it's constantly moving and your device talks to a different satellite all the time and it can change as quickly as every 8 to 10 minutes in some cases.
On a clear night, if you're looking up and you see a satellite moving through the sky, it's generally in a low or medium orbit, not in a geostationary orbit. You wouldn't be able to see
that
a bird sitting out that far.
And it's interesting. It's a fun sort of cost-benefit analysis sort of equation, and it's not necessarily money cost, but other things that come into play of, you know, low Earth orbit is lower latency because
it's closer.
It's closer, right? The latency, you know, people get on board and they're like, oh, 800 millisecond traffic latency from a satellite internet connection, this sucks. That's basically the speed of light. I think 660 milliseconds is about as good as you can get for something to go from an airplane 5 miles up to 22,000 miles up,
back to
Earth, get to a web server somewhere, do its thing, and then repeat that process in reverse.
Sorry, it's just magic.
But yeah.
You know, let's be realistic here. It's magic.
But low Earth orbit is obviously much lower. So instead of 22,000 miles, it's a couple hundred miles. So you still a decent ways, but light travels pretty quickly. And so, you know, the signal can propagate that much faster. So you get down into the 100 millisecond latency range, which makes a big difference for some things.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't really matter for streaming video most of the time. It doesn't really matter for... matters a little bit for generic web pages, but not a ton, depending on what the content is. You're not going to be a day trader, and you're not going to play sort of the online games that require, you know, the shoot 'em up games. I don't even know what they're called anymore.
No, first-person shooters.
The first-person shooters. Yeah, you're not going to be playing those.
Not that I play them, but...
At least you know it. You're not going to be playing those on these systems just because you'll be losing every time with the latency. But anyway, back to this sort of the F4 of the I-5 network. It's really going to be interesting to see how they put it into place and what it ends up covering, and if they really do move it around. I mean, at one point yesterday, the CEO was talking about, oh, maybe we'll use it to cover India.
Yeah.
Of course, we have to build infrastructure in India because that's their rules, sort of like China has similar rules if you want to have a satellite that delivers to Chinese companies or people. The base, the ground station, has to be in China, and in their case, it's because everything routes through the Great Firewall. They're monitoring the traffic. But I'm not sure how much of that is India monitoring versus just wanting to have some control and sort of be able to at some point. But yeah.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, Inmarsat, first of all, spent the money to build F4 when global coverage only required 3 satellites.
And then launched it.
I mean, the idea is to have an in-orbit spare in case of a catastrophic failure of one of the other 3. Sure. Things happen.
Sure.
Going back as far as, you know, in the 80s and 90s, a solar storm whacked Canadian satellites, Telesat's Annex, put them out of control for a day or two. The ground control was able to reestablish them, one of them only partially. One of them came back to full service. And there's been other instances, unfortunately, of battery issues, electrical issues, or just simply the lifespan of a satellite being around 15 years. You end up kind of running out of juice or the actual equipment on board starts to fall apart. So how long do you keep a satellite in service? Do you keep it in orbit, or do you create something that's flexible enough on the ground that when you're ready to orbit it, it has the latest technology? Because now they got F4 up there. If they put it into service, do you just put it in if there isn't capacity needs? Or do you just let it sit there waiting for something to fail? Well, it's an interesting...
It is interesting, and I guess the real question there is the cost factor at that point just becomes ground station.
Well, once you've paid
operations
for the launch and the satellite, it's there.
It's there. So, like, why wouldn't you put it into service? And I think the only reason would be sort of ground station costs and those links, because everything else is paid for at that point. Like, you know, the 15-year lifespan is partly the hardware dying and partly fuel on board.
That's right.
Even though it's in orbit, you still have to, like, you know, it still expends a little bit of fuel every now and then to stay in this box.
Yeah.
This cube that it sits in that's, you know, I want to say it's like 40 miles.
It's not very big.
Yeah. Miles seems huge, but it's 22,000 miles away, so it's a pretty small spot to...
Yeah.
Small target to hit.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool that any of this stuff works. I'm with you that it's all magic.
It is. It's magic. I mean, the fact that you can sit on the ground, grab something that looks like a big wok, point it at the sky, and watch television or get data or play on the internet. Let's not even talk about the geometry of doing it in an aircraft flying at 500 miles an hour and banking and turning and descending and climbing.
Yeah.
It makes my head hurt. And I understand the concept of orbital dynamics and how...
So you've got a background in satellite communications a little bit.
Well, a little bit. Yeah, my longest career was in television broadcasting. Spent many, many years regulatory, programming, management. Played around on the technical side. I started off as a videotape operator when there was actually videotape.
Well, there you go.
I jokingly say when there were steam-powered VTRs. But I actually worked on some of the early Ku-band satellite stuff at the stations and networks I worked with. And, in fact, helped put together the satellite map and communications map for the first Live 8 that happened way back when. Directed it in for the Canadian service that was participating, Much Music. So I know how a little bit of this works.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild to think that we've progressed to the point with Ka band that we have the bandwidth to be able to stream pretty well to every seat.
Yeah.
An interesting question that I love asking the folks from the companies, the service companies, satellite service companies, is what percentage of the overall bandwidth that's available out there really is going to end up being devoted to AeroConnect? You know, as a percentage of all of that.
Right.
How much is it? And my own feeling is that I don't think it's going to be more than, you know, 5%, something like that, when you think about how many people might connect at any given time versus what terrestrial, military, government, oceanic, maritime.
These same satellites are supporting not just the airplanes.
Exactly.
And in most cases, very little of it is airplanes. I mean,
it's sexy.
Yeah. Oh, listen, it's our business.
It's
I love
our business.
It.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I use it all the time, but it's an interesting question, especially when you look at many of these providers. I think Gogo is probably the only provider that doesn't have other services.
Mm-hmm.
right? If you look at Inmarsat, Panasonic,
Viasat,
Global Eagle, all those guys have something else in play. Eutelsat in Europe. I mean, they're, all of these operators have terrestrial or maritime or oil rigs, you know, offshore or military operations, and often many of those things combined.
So where does that put Gogo, do you think,
Seth? Do you think they, challenging they, position.
Do you think they're at risk?
I do. It's an interesting challenge. I think what they face is the other guys sort of can subsidize the cost of aero, which is very expensive to deliver.
Mm-hmm.
The antennas are smaller, so inherently less efficient. There's other challenges that come along with it, just from certification costs, because putting things on airplanes is neither cheap nor easy.
A whole lot more expensive than just sticking it on the roof of a bank.
Yeah. Way more complicated in so many ways. And so if you've got, you know, if you're Viasat and you've got 700,000 home customers and 700 airplanes, right? I mean, that's a 1,000-to-1 ratio.
Well, how many users at any given time? Like, you know, if they...
And yeah, there's always going to be more than one user on every airplane. And
right.
So that skews the volume of traffic dynamics a little bit. But if they can charge a reasonably profitable rate for the terrestrial users, those home users, there's usually much better margins there,
mm-hmm.
as I understand it. And I might have this all wrong, but I've been led to believe that there's better margins there. And there's people who buy, you know, the super streaming package and don't really use it and things like that. So they have a buffer that helps them when their aero costs spike. They can balance it out and sort of amortize it across the satellite usage across the sort of blended usage of everything.
Right.
And I think that helps them. I think when you've got a Global Eagle or a Panasonic, each of which has in the last couple of years bought a massive maritime operation and has the ability to, again, sort of split their costs across those ways. In many cases, because the satellites don't move, you're lighting up a part of the ocean, right? It's over the aero, it's over the airplane routes, but you've got
a spot beam or a larger beam over.
But let's talk about like the transatlantic route map.
Sure.
There's, you know, from North America to Europe, transatlantic route is that arch that goes up New England, across Nova Scotia, across the southern tip of Greenland, across Iceland, Ireland, and then down into Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Many of us have flown it far too many times. And it's used for a couple hours every day. There's a fleet of planes that go over in the evening and a fleet of planes that come back during the day. U.S. times, obviously, I'm based biased, but it works. And the rest of the day, those transponders are still on. A Panasonic, a Gogo, any of these companies have still leased that capacity. What do you do with it the rest of the day? You're still essentially paying to have that capacity there. And if I can only use a beam for 4 out of 24 hours, that's not efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And airlines know this especially because they basically make money on aircraft utilization. And maybe that route isn't a great example because there's no shipping routes that go that far north, but the concept of, okay, well, there's airplanes in it for 4 hours a day. A ship moves a lot slower, but can be passing through many of the same general route areas. And some of it's, you know, a broad beam that covers wider areas. But
without knowing the business plan on the maritime side, it's hard to analyze how many ships are actually contributing to the overall revenue stream. You know,
we heard from Inmarsat that they've got 1,000. Ships deployed on this Global Express, this GX network. They call it Fleet Express for the maritime version.
Yeah.
They say they've got 1,000 active systems installed. So they don't have 1,000 airline customers signed up, aircraft caught.
So do you think, I mean, you're following this as much as I am and some of our colleagues out there. Pardon me. Do you think that we're getting to that holy grail, that everybody on board an aircraft is going to be able to stream either the Super Bowl or the World Cup final and watch whichever one they want in high def, real time? Because that, I see that as being
the answer,
the ultimate achievement, so the ultimate objective, that if you can do that, if you have the bandwidth to do that, the flexibility to do that, whether it's air to ground, whether it's KA, whether it's KU, doesn't matter. That's the pipe.
As long as you have the option. Right. And I absolutely agree with you that it doesn't matter how you get there as long as you get there.
Exactly.
I think your target's slightly off, and I'll tell you why. If I wanted everybody to watch the Super Bowl or
a football match or whatever it is, I can stream that a single stream and redistribute it on the plane.
Okay.
For a live event, especially if...
That's easy.
Right, that's easy.
Yeah, you're right.
The real question is, can I stream 150 different matches?
That would be an interesting challenge.
No. The answer today is no.
Right.
It doesn't exist yet. They're getting close in some cases. I was on the GoGo test flight last week, and so days are blending, last Tuesday, and we got over 100 megabits to the aircraft.
Pretty good.
So if you say a stream is between a half and a megabit per passenger, you're starting to get there. We were the only aircraft using that beam.
Mm-hmm. You were not maneuvering terribly.
We weren't banking and doing a lot of crazy things. Although we did have one, it was a joyride. So we basically flew north out of Newark, got to Vermont, turned around, and came home.
And there weren't any other... I'm interested to see what's going to happen when we start hitting a density of aircraft.
Right, so we were the only aircraft in
a terminal area.
Yeah, we were the only aircraft in that spot beam.
Yeah.
But we did have one point where, we got to Vermont, and it was like, oh, time to go home, and pilot basically hung a left. And you could feel it. It was a long turn. We probably did not a full 180, but, 150-degree turn. And stayed connected the whole time.
Cool.
So, again, the systems are getting better at being able to track satellites. The antenna networks or the antenna hardware is getting better. The modems are getting better. All these things are getting better. There's not enough bandwidth in the sky to do that for all the planes that want to have this service.
Right.
When there's one plane, it works. When you give me 1,000 planes, I don't think that you certainly can't put 100 planes in one of these spot beams and have everybody pull 100 megabits. That's...
And do you think
that's 10 gigabit? That and
the numbers, right?
The numbers don't add up. And we also hear these you can get 15 megabits per passenger, you get 12 megabits per passenger. These sort of, and they claim that they can. The vendors claim that they can document that on average, when a user clicks a button, the system will deliver the equivalent of that speed. But that's not 12 megabits committed to every passenger. That's 12 or 15 megabits. Hypothetical, and it's sort of a shared thing. While you're reading the web page and not reloading it, someone else is using the bandwidth, and then you click the link while they're reading their page, and so it sort of balances out.
The analogy I think about is the power ports at every seat, where it's a shared resource throughout the entire aircraft. When you plug
in... Most people don't know that.
Yeah, but that's what it is.
Yeah.
There's only a finite amount of power that they can distribute within that system. So when you plug in to charge your smartphone or your tablet or something, you're sharing that power. And it might cycle through, and in fact, it might be balanced so that business or the few first class passengers have it all the time.
Yeah.
Where all of us back in steerage have it cycle through the different outlets on a regular basis.
That outlet you have that you think you're supposed to pull 75 or 90 watts from.
Yeah, good luck.
Might not actually deliver it.
That's right. Or it might not deliver it right now,
but
a minute from now.
You'll get a little more later.
You'll get a little bit more.
Fun fact, since we're talking about that, not all the vendors do it the same way. Some mm-hmm. of them isolate sort of small groups of seats, whether it's 6 or 24, sort of like blocks. Imagine like circuit breakers in a house. You can isolate chunks of it.
Yeah.
But typically, if you've ever been in the experience where you're plugged in and you sort of get a brownout or a blackout on your outlet, typically the way those work is the guy who's been plugged in the longest gets blacked out or browned out. But it's not so smart as to realize that a quick unplug replug means that you didn't really unplug. And so if you ever feel like it's getting a little weird like that on your outlet, just unplug, count to 3 and plug it back in. And you go back to the top of the list in terms of, I've only been plugged in for 3 seconds. What do you mean I'm up? And so
Secrets of power on an airplane, Seth Miller.
You basically start pulling more power again. So if you ever think you're getting, shorted on the power, try unplugging and replugging. You might be surprised what you get out of it.
One other thing that I noticed that just recently happened in the space side was with Iridium Next.
Yeah.
Arion has had some successful tests. With a whole bunch of pings.
So Arion is a flight tracking solution. They use ADS-B, which stands for something, but it's basically the GPS tracking solution instead of radar. And every aircraft broadcasts...
Automatic dependent surveillance?
Sure. Dash-B. Okay.
Dash-B. I believe that's what it is.
Okay. They basically...
I might be wrong. Somebody's going to correct me.
Yeah. That means we get comments. We like this. usually it's people correcting us. We get those a lot, too. So basically it broadcasts your GPS position out through a radio signal. And historically, that's how a Flight Radar 24 or Flight Aware, most of those services work, certainly when they have the good detailed information. And historically, that's been a radio broadcast to an antenna somewhere on the ground.
Yeah.
Obviously, that does not work when you're flying over oceans. And as we had with MH370, as we've had with
you know, there have been instances,
Air France 447,
there have been scenarios where planes have gone missing and we didn't have the most up-to-date data. This solves that. The Ariane payload is essentially a shoebox that sits on the corner of these Iridium satellites.
Which aren't that big in the first place.
They aren't that big in the first place, but it's a tiny little receiver that sits there, and it can receive the ADS-B signal in space. And so planes, when they're broadcasting it out, it turns out it goes up and down. So that works well for the Ariane solution. And they finally turned on a couple of their payloads after a couple of months ago when the first Iridiums went into service. And I think they like turned one on. I'll see if I can find the tweet. They turned one on.
Yeah, the numbers were incredible.
And the numbers were astounding. They turned one of the 10 that had been launched on.
Yeah.
And so you had nowhere close to full global coverage. It was basically in one circle just going around and around and around. And
it was thousands, wasn't it?
Yeah. Thousands and thousands of aircraft tracks.
Yeah. Nice to see that my friends at NAV Canada are part of the team that's putting this together. And
they were one of the early commitments.
And they're actually developing it along with Ariane. And it's going to benefit air traffic service providers around the world who are involved with it.
And we've heard.
And it's just one of the solutions.
Sure.
Actually.
Yeah, and you supposedly know, the FAA is going to get on board, but.
And the ICAO regulations stating how often an aircraft is going to have to
report its position.
Report its position and all the rest of the stuff that's going along with it. It's all good, but it also begs the question of who's going to analyze all the data.
Yeah.
What kind of smart algorithms are going to be in place to know that an aircraft is diverting from a flight path?
Yeah. How have we figured out? You know, we know where you are. Is that where you were supposed to be?
Precisely.
And that's a big extra set of questions to ask. There's also,
if you're not where you're supposed to be, what can we do about it?
Yeah. And not everybody is using that as their tracking solution. I know Qatar Airways actually has to deal with, I believe, Inmarsat.
Yep.
For their Swift broadband safety tracking solution,
which is L-band,
and that's another sort of global constellation. But they're going to track their aircraft a different way, and that's going to all feed back into their operations center in Doha and sort of.
But again, the good thing, doesn't matter what the pipe is, the good thing is that we're getting to the point that aircraft are going to be tracked in real time,
yeah,
or near real time.
Yeah, it's going to be good stuff. Looking forward to it.
It is. So what did you think of the launch?
I thought it was amazing. We watched it from different places.
Yeah.
So I think this is...
It's kind of neat.
I went out onto the causeway, which they basically drove us on a bus and dropped us off a couple of miles south of the launch pad.
Yeah.
And, you know, sort of looking up across the water, the inlet, the intercoastal or the swamplands, the marshlands of Florida, watching it go off. And it was, you know, you dial into a conference bridge to listen to the launch sequence because we could watch a webcast, but the webcast, because it's through the web, is delayed. And so we're watching it, and you hear someone yells 30. You know, I sort of had my phone listening to it, except that my phone crashed, and it was awful. But we heard someone yells 30 seconds, and so everybody, you know, perks up, and yeah, like everybody around's counting down the 10, 9, 8, you know, the clock and whatever. And all of a sudden, you see the fire. You see the launch happening. You don't hear it. You don't feel it. You're so far away that it was probably 15 to 20 seconds before we heard and felt it.
Hmm.
It was actually kind of surprising. Like, and you're hearing the noise come from the wrong place at this point because it launches and it creates an arc. And so we're turning and watching the arc as it goes off into orbit. And then the noise from the launch pad comes at us. So it was cool. It was a little disconcerting, and a little confused, not disconcerting, but confusing sort of mentally. Like, why is the noise over there when the rocket's over here? But it was really, really neat to see it. I've watched them on, you know, online, on video, whatever, so many times. Forget just how fast it goes.
That was one of the things that amazed me. It was my first launch. I've been watching launches on television or online, and I'll just say those can do the calculations. I remember seeing the Mercury Redstone suborbital flights when I was very young, but I do remember watching them. So this, for me, was my first launch live. It was rather incredible, and I'm still somewhat speechless over
it.
So you were standing
in front of the countdown clock.
I was standing in front of the countdown clock, the famous countdown clock, except it's the new countdown clock. They've made a digital screen, and half the screen shows the countdown. The other half of the screen actually shows the SpaceX feed.
Oh.
So I could watch the video. I could watch the video, the live shots from the rocket as it was launching. Just steps, some folks will remember when I make this reference, steps from where Walter Cronkite sat in the CBS booth watching the Saturns go off to the moon.
Yeah.
Which was, it's quite a kick. A lot of history there. A lot of history.
Yeah, those booths are all still there.
They're all still there. Some of them are looking worse for wear from hurricanes and
I'm not sure any of them are functional and habitable, but they're all still there.
Yeah, but we were 3 miles from the pad.
Okay.
And there was a lot of trees, a lot of vegetation that had grown up over the years. So we couldn't quite see the bottom of the pad.
Interesting.
So as it hit zero, you could see the plume of the steam coming off from the engines igniting with the water suppression system. And about a second or two later, I could just see the top of the rocket start to move up above the gantry. And by about T plus 7, it was mostly above the launch gantry area. And I could see the full rocket plume as well. And I would say it took about 10 to 12 seconds before the noise started.
Yeah.
And then after the noise began, it became an intense crackling and just a really overwhelming noise. And then the ground started vibrating.
Nice.
And it shook. I mean, I wanted to take photos, but I also didn't want to experience it through the viewfinder of my camera. So I let my camera drop on its strap around my neck, and I spent about 10 or 15 seconds just watching it go up and do the arc before I picked up my camera, and the vibration kind of had eased off by then. It was amazing to see how fast it got out of town. It just was gone.
Yeah, I mean, it heads out to sea, and it's not wasting any time.
It's out of sight. And if you watch the launch on the SpaceX feed, you can see how fast it's actually accelerating.
Yeah.
It's quite amazing and how quickly it's climbing. But this was a single-core Falcon 9, which has been the booster that SpaceX has been using.
It's the upgraded model, right?
The upgraded model, because they wouldn't have been able to...
The 1.2, so it's got a little higher thrust.
Yeah, they call it the FT, the full thrust version.
Okay.
This satellite was originally intended for the follow-on to this...
The Heavy.
The booster, the Falcon Heavy. Now, the Falcon that we saw today has 9 rockets, 9 engines in it. The Falcon Heavy is going to have 3 cores strapped together, so it's going to have 27 engines firing at the same time. So if what we experienced tonight was remarkable, that's going to be extraordinary.
Yeah.
And the most amazing part of it is that after it launches, the 2 outer boosters are going to separate. They're going to do their flip, boost back to the Cape, and both land probably within a second or two of each other on separate pads. And then, the main will either land on the drone ship or come back to the Cape as well. So that's going to be something to watch, and stay tuned for that later this year.
Yeah, that's going to be...
at least that's what SpaceX
is
saying.
That's the timing
that's
expected. All right.
So that was really neat. It was an amazing day. I started off much earlier than you did.
That's right. As a foreigner, you had to go for your credentials at
Dark
30.
That's right. Exactly.
So, I was sitting on the beach working.
Well, I took that picture and tweeted it out.
Yes.
Make sure that everybody out there knew exactly how hard you were working this morning.
There was no umbrella drinks. I was writing stories. I may have had a little sun to go with it, but...
Good thing to do. There's nothing wrong with that at all.
When the office is the beach, you work on the beach. It's what it is.
That's right. So this has been fun.
Yes.
How are we? Are we almost out of time?
We are wrapping it up. Why don't you tell folks where they can find you online?
Oh, okay. Well, that's always important.
If anyone still wants to follow
really,
up and see what's going on.
Yeah, because space geekery is just one piece of it. We never got into the av geekery either.
No, we skipped airplanes this time. But
yeah, because today was all about space.
The bar is going to probably close soon. I'm sure we'll get another drink, I think.
Could be. Yeah, this is all about space. So that's what this is. We're in the world of space here at Cocoa Beach.
Yeah, space capital.
This is one of them, other than in Baikonur in Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
I'm on Twitter, at Howard Slutskin, and you can also find me on Facebook. I've been writing for the good folks at the Airline Passenger Experience Association for a few years now, and get to cover all sorts of nifty stuff, including this launch, for them. And I also do work for a couple of wonderfully visual magazines based in Canada, Skies Magazine and Vertical, both of which have incredible photography, thanks to editor Mike Reno's focus, no pun intended or pun intended, to make sure. And I have a good time writing for those folks. And still do some work for my buddies at airlinereporter.com and Airways News, where I kind of started off really only a whole 3 years ago. Along the way, I've done a couple of pieces for Flight International and for Aviation Week and Space Technology, which is a real kick.
Awesome.
And that's what I'm doing.
So you get around.
I'm one of those freelance people that...
actually freelances.
I actually freelance, and it's not about, would you do this? It's more, sure, when would you like it?
Awesome. And you can find Dots, Lines, and Destination on Twitter at Dots, Lines. You can find us at moredotsmorelines.com. leave us a comment, leave us some feedback, let us know what you think, and we'll be back to our, sadly, I think, in some ways, back to our regularly scheduled programming, talking about, you know, travel that us mere mortals can actually take next week. Take care. Have a great trip.
Thanks, Seth. Take care.